Let's roll the tape. My name is Deanne Lagerquist. When I'm not at Holden Village, I teach at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota, in the religion department and in the para-college. I always say both of those because I think the para-college sort of balances out people's idea that the religion department is boring. What I'm going to do today in this session, which is entitled Reflections on In the Image of God, is something I've never done before at a session at Holden Village. I consulted a couple of people who said, oh, go ahead, try it. So we'll see how it works. This summer, one of the things that I've been doing is several writing projects. And one of them is for a periodical called The Crescent, which is published by Valparaiso University. It's a review of politics, the arts, and religion, or something like that. If you want to check it out before you leave, I'm sure we have copies of it out here. I know that Holden Village is a subscriber to that journal. There's always a section in that periodical called Letters. And unlike letters to an editor in many journals, the letters in the Crescent are usually from people who have traveled somewhere. So there was a series of two letters recently from one of my former colleagues reflecting on a trip he took to Africa. He's a scholar of African religions, and it was his first time he'd ever been in Africa. So he was describing everything he saw and with great excitement. Another woman had been doing volunteer work in Central America, a professor of Spanish. Took part of her sabbatical to do volunteer work in Central America. And she wrote about that. Well, the editor of this journal is a dear friend of mine, and whenever I see her, she buys me food on the Crescent budget, so I owed her. She'd been quite generous about it for several months, and finally she said, Deanne, this summer I need something from you. So I thought, I had several ideas about what I might write about while I was at Holden for that letter section. I thought I might write about Holden. I thought I might write about something that had occurred to me often last summer, namely home. Last summer we used every week on Friday a version of the Lord's Prayer that comes from the Mother Thunder Mission that starts out with the words, Holy One, our only home, which I think is a beautiful beginning to that prayer. And it struck me that despite the fact last summer we had a lot of controversy about Abba Ema, nobody ever complained about Holy One, our only home. And I thought that was interesting, that I might play with what it means to be at home as a religious concept. But when I got here and began to think about this summer's theme, In the Image of God, that became the topic of my essay. And my experiment is that I'm just going to read it to you. The reason I'm going to read it to you is because I worked really hard on these sentences, and I like them. So I did try to extract an outline, and I was going to just, you know, talk to you about it. But instead, I'll just kind of run through the outline so that you know where we're going. I think it's easier to listen if you know where we're going. First of all, there's a bit of an introduction. Then there's some discussion about what an image is. And then throughout the essay, I developed four different ways or four different reflections maybe on In the Image of God. And this little thing here is because I list these two in one order but discuss them in a different order. One is images for God. The next is images to be made in the image of God, then Christ as the image of the invisible God, and then imitation of Christ. And then finally there's a paragraph about worship, and finally I get back to home. The other thing I should say is that there's one section where I use the words creator, creature, and creation. And obviously, creator is God. Creature here refers to humans, and creation to the rest of creation, distinguished from creature. I think with that, you should be able to follow. I don't think this will take the whole time, and so I hope that when I'm done, that we'll be able to talk about some of the ideas that come up here. Usually I'm happy for you to break in the middle. I think today I'd like you to jot down a little note so you remember what you want to say at the end. Okay. Holden Village is not paradise. We did drive through Paradise, Montana, as our route from Minnesota dropped south from Glacier National Park. Passing through that tiny town, even at highway speed, I noted some similarities to Holden. First, the Montana settlement is not much larger than a village. Second, it is located in a long valley, enclosed by steep mountain slopes with a river running nearby. Access to Holden Village is inconvenient enough that some folks might expect to find St. Peter waiting for them when they finish the three-hour boat trip up Lake Chelan and the 45-minute drive up switchbacks in a retired school bus. But before sighting the village itself, a bus rider who is attentive will see the huge tailing piles, remnants of the Howe Sound copper mining operation. This humanly constructed desert is a silent but dramatic sign that Holden Village is not paradise. Its existence is built on three decades of mining and the mine closure, not in cosmic response to God's imperative word. Nonetheless, Holden Village is not the reverse of paradise either. Its small human community and its isolated location on the edge of a wilderness area combine to produce a place apart, as early publicity material claimed. Although my weeks in the village correspond with ordinary time in the church's calendar, they are distinctly unlike my ordinary usual life the other months of the year. Of course, there are characteristic Holden foods, lentil loaf, egg caca, trout for breakfast, and solidarity dinners of rice or bread. And there is the din of over 200 people, some of them children, sharing the meal. There's dish team. There are water-saving measures and fire alarms. But these are relatively superficial changes. More significant is the opportunity, even in the midst of busy days, to meditate upon the one who made both the community and its setting. The community's discipline, morning matins, teaching sessions, and vespers, and the discipline of living in a smallish group of people in the midst of a larger, ever-changing one, both give occasions and make necessary frequent reflection. Similarly, proximity to both the delicate beauty of a wild rose and the dramatic power of Ten Mile Falls calls for contemplation. In the image of God, this summer's theme focuses these disparate thoughts and conversations. At first the theme seems obvious, so bland, too easy. Of course, we all know what it is about. Two meanings spring quickly, dictionary-like, to mind. One, according to Genesis 1, the priestly account of creation, humanity was made by God's command, in God's image. Two, despite the prohibition against graven images, throughout the scriptural witness and Christian tradition, we encounter a chaotic array of images for God, from potter to rock, from king to servant, from silent stillness to rushing wind, from infant son to maternal eagle. But an image is not a dictionary definition, and as the summer passes, what becomes obvious is that in the image of God is neither easy nor bland. In the midst of the reflections on humanity, nature, and God that I am propelled into by this place, the familiar phrase is a powerful compass directing my exploration, finally pointing toward the magnetic center of the cosmos. If image is not definition, what is it? Recourse to a dictionary yields an explanation from physics. An image is the optical counterpart of an object or a person that appears through the use of a lens or a mirror. The image of a thing is not the thing itself, but the geometrical figure made up of the foci corresponding to the points of the object. A lens, mirror, or other optical system allows us to see an image like the object, but not the object. We recognize the image on the basis of its correspondence to the points of the object. Or more truthfully, we learn to recognize the object in its image. As children, a child does not immediately know its own reflection in a mirror. Even as adults, we're often taken aback by our appearance in a photograph. Along with the correspondence, there is also distortion. The experience is more vivid in a funhouse mirror designed to distort, or in the polished base of a brass lamp, where I watched my face grow long and then shrink, when as a child I moved closer and then further away from the base. An image is not a definition. It is a representation, a likeness, that allows us to see with our eyes something no longer or never present before us. When the image is a solid sculpture, a flat painting, or a moving videotape, the eye is part of the optical system. When the image is a poem, a song, or a creed, the eye and the ear are assisted by the imagination. Language projects the image on the mind's eye and recalls what was once known or presents what the eye has not yet seen. But as in physics, so too in literature, art, theology, the image only corresponds to points of what it represents. Between the points, there is space for distortion or disorientation, even for concealment. An image is a representation revealing its object by likeness and veiling it by unlikeness. Images of God, images for God, whether in words or in solid forms of people or piles of stone, show us something about God. All around me at Holden Village, the creation reveals its maker. Natural power pulls a cedar up from its ancient roots and also plants a seedling in the decaying trunk. Knowing from the scripture that God brings good from evil, life from death, I'm not surprised. Rather, I recognize in the image a likeness of the familiar. Masses of purple lupine punctuated by dashes of red paintbrush confirm the beauty of the extravagant creator who clothes the lilies, confirms the beauty perhaps too easily. Above the color juts a mountain of alluring beauty and power. Even I, who yearned for the horizontal vastness of a prairie horizon, am drawn by the mountain's rugged ascent toward the sky. Lulled by generosity, by gushing waterfalls, we are stunned when the unforgiving mountain takes the life of a 20-year-old hiker. What of the mother eagle with her young? What of God who watches out for the sparrows? This young man's body was alone on a ledge for 7 evenings and 7 mornings, and then for 3 more. His death disorients the village. No more than we know why he climbed alone can we know why the holy shepherd allowed this single lamb to fall. There is no satisfying answer to our question, why? Instead, we turn from theodicy to epiphany. Gail Ramshaw writes that the God of the mountain without God of the volcano is mush. The volcano is beyond our power, beyond our control, perhaps even beyond our imagining. I do not know why Herman fell. I do know that his death raises a reminder, not that God is cruel or absent, but that even the creation is a broken, partial reflection of its maker, who is hidden by nature as well as revealed in it. Photographs and paintings of Mount Bonanza now stand guard, lest I presume to equate God with this image for the divine. In the space between the corresponding points of wildflower beauty and cascade power, there is much of God that I do not comprehend, though I am made in the image of God. Genesis 1 declares that we human beings are made in God's image and likeness, and the Yahwist of chapter 2 gives more clues to the points of similarity. Adam is made by clay and animated by God, is made from clay and animated by God's breath. Then Eve is also crafted from something made by God, namely Adam's rib. Excuse me. Do they look like God? I think not. The easiest, most obvious meaning of image is not what is intended, although many of our images for God draw upon what we see, upon our immediate experience, for as Dorothy Sayers asserted, we have no other yardstick. An image depends upon the known to direct us toward a revealing of the unknown. That we humans are made in God's image tells us something about God and something about ourselves, but not everything about either. Between the points of likeness are vast spaces. Sayers suggested further that since the primary characteristic of God in Genesis 1 is the ability to create, to be made in that image is to be creative, imaginative, makers. Others look to the later command to have dominion as the key to similarity between creator and creature, or to rationality, or to consciousness. I find Sayers' view appealing, especially her emphasis on human imaginative capacity in her discussion of the creative idea. Without imagination, we would know nothing of yesterday, of the past, for memory is a sort of imagination recalling what was. Without imagination, we would know nothing of tomorrow, of the future, for hope is a sort of imagination anticipating what might be. Faith requires imagination, even as imagination reveals the necessity of faith by showing us our limits, the ways we are unable to move beyond the good that is, or to escape evil. Imagining motivates response to God, both fear and gratitude. Although with the psalmist we may see the trees clapping their hands in praise of God, we know that the cedars and the alders neither have hands nor clap. But we do both. We have hands and we clap them, conscious of our closeness to and our distance from God. Even so, we glory in the similarity, the correspondence, and each point of correspondence implies a difference from the rest of creation. The creature is like the creator, as creation is not. And the creature is not like the creation. Not like? Does that mean better? Is the image of God superior to the source of images for God? All of creation, all God's creatures, have been given abilities. The mountain is more enduring than we. The bear is stronger. The deer is faster. The bird can fly. Human beings imagine, anticipate, remember, respond, make, and destroy. This last raises the issue of superiority in a different tone. Since leaving the garden, we have walked heavily upon the earth from which we were made. In this valley, I see the great rusty scars, piles of tailings, skeleton of the copper mill, and every day fresh new garbage is dug into the ground or burned into the sky. Being aware and careful does not protect us or the creation from ourselves, from one another's unkindnesses. Creation's difference from creature may be that we are worse, using what God meant for good to evil ends. Let us not forget, however, that nature is not altogether kind either. Indeed, this may be a wrong turn in the exploration, false issues leading us into a thicket. That human beings are made in the image of God may have less to do with endowments such as intellect, consciousness, and imagination, and all to do with the relationships formed by the divine making. The creation stories are images of this truth, reflected in the mirror of myth. The first account is much concerned with things made according to their kind, separated in the act of creation but linked in the story. All this God pronounced good. In Genesis 2, we read that the Creator linked us to the earth by making the first of our kind, Adam, the earthling, from it. The search for a suitable companion, finally made from Adam, distinguishes humanity from the rest of creation without negating the connection. Further, it shows the human need for sociability, the fact that one cannot be human alone. The image of God in humanity is a triangular relationality to Creator, to other human creatures, and to the rest of creation. In each we see reflections of God, imperfect images. Love of neighbor and love of the beauty of the world, Simone Weil identified as immediate objects for the implicit love of God, which is our ultimate end. In doing so, she did not collapse either the neighbor or the world into God or into self. The distinctions between the three, God, human, and world, are crucial to the relationships between them. An image is made of points of correspondence surrounded by spaces of difference. The thing itself is not its image. And yet Weil observes that when human beings restrain the power that would allow the stronger to overcome the weaker and treat that other creature or creation as equal, we act our relationships with inseparable generosity and compassion. Both, she continues, have their model in God, that is to say, in creation and in the Passion. God's generous, compassionate attention to us evokes pure gratitude, which accepts that we are in God's image, but not God, and recognizes that God is not compelled to love us, and yet does. One of the impediments to recognizing the image of God that is in us is that we have not yet seen God. I am able to recognize each of my brothers in photographs and to see their features in mind because I know them face to face. God we know only from a distance, through imperfect representations, then vividly through the more exact image, incarnation. A third meaning of the familiar phrase. 3. Christ is the image of the invisible God. Here is the magnetic center drawing all of creation together. The stereoscope of old-fashioned parlors and modern aerial photography labs gives the illusion of three-dimensional relief to flat images. Even more, Jesus' self-emptying appearance on earth animates our images for God. Now the Most Holy One reaches across distortions and space to heal us, the broken image. Once made from clay, our eyes are opened when Jesus anoints them with clay. We come to see God, the source of our life and of our triangular connections, is a triunity of relationality. If we forget this and look only to a single aspect of the whole, our view of God becomes flat. Every image corresponds only at a few points, so others are needed to fill in the spaces and to correct the distortions. The distant God of the volcano is the same holy shepherd searching for one lost lamb, and the eagle bearing up the young under her wings. Not only were we once created good, but now we are healed and being nourished. So too the rest of creation, though we have thought less about the redemption of creation than about our own. Like Mount Bonanza, misnamed by a forgotten cartographer's transposition, the Trinity draws us back to divine mystery, lest we become lost in too easy images. And God's enfleshment brings a fourth meaning. 4. To be in the image of God is to imitate Christ. Recalling what was, we hope with faith for what is to be. A renewal of the triangle of relationships more perfectly representing God who is their source. Once made in the image of the Creator, now we are remade in the image of Christ. Watching the snow melt cascade down the mountain into the creek and there relentlessly carve into the earth, undermining giant trees, sculpting stones, I am reminded that God is powerful and persistent in this work of recreating. Reconciling the image to its object is not an easy task. Learning to be a little Christ to neighbor and to the world is a daily discipline carried out in every ordinary place. It is accepting our real connections to Creator, creation, and creatures, relinquishing false claims. Again, Veal. To give up our imaginary position as the center, to renounce it, not only intellectually, but in the imaginative part of our soul, means to awaken to what is real and eternal, to see the true light and to hear the true silence. It is a transformation analogous to that which takes place in the dusk of evening on a road, where we suddenly discern as a tree what we have first seen as a stooping man, or where we suddenly recognize as a rustling of leaves what we had thought at first was whispering voices. We see the same colors, we hear the same sounds, but not in the same way. To imitate Christ is to cultivate corresponding generosity and compassion. It is to accept God's love for us with pure gratitude. Love of religious ceremonies is Veal's third immediate object for immediate love of God. Worship brings the image of God, humans, into concentrated contact with images for God in order that our seeing will be transformed and we will recognize God in one another, in the world, and in the Word and Sacrament. At Holden Village, surrounded by God's creation, in the company of God's people, we gather in the evening to worship. Often we begin in silence before the power and beauty of the triune mystery. Some evenings we join the trees, clapping our hands in gratitude. Weekly we eat and drink God made real to us in the fruits of the earth. We embrace one another in God's own peace, anticipating what will be. Nonetheless, Holden Village is only a wavering image, like the weak radio signal that barely penetrates into this place apart. Holden Village projects a message. I hear the message clearly when we join the Christians of Mother Thunder Mission and begin our prayer, Holy One, our only home. No place is paradise except where we will finally see God, not in a mirror dimly, but face to face. Responses, questions, annoyances. Quiet. You don't have to say anything, but you can if you. Thank you, Elizabeth. I think one of the things that I found really wonderful as I worked on it, there are quotations in there from three women, Gail Ramshaw, and some of you who were in my session on Monday night heard a little section from her book, Letters for God's Name, this thing about the mountain, God of the mountain, God of the volcano is from V in that book. And Dorothy Sayers, who some of you may know as a mystery novelist, also wrote theological essays. And the pieces in here about creativity and imagination come from a series of essays she wrote called The Mind of the Maker. And then the third is Simone Veil, who was a French Jew, a contemporary of Dietrich Bonhoeffer during World War II, who, although she was never baptized, I think really can be considered a Christian theologian, certainly a Christian mystic. Well, I found it really wonderful as I was working on this that the three of them had such corresponding ideas to what I was thinking about. It was really gratifying to be reading them at the same time and to come upon things that, oh, that's just what I was grasping for. Yes, yes, that's just what I wanted to say. And I would commend any of those three authors to you. Let me just write them up here. Of the three, only one of them, I think, is available in the bookstore. The first is Gail. She now uses Gail Ramshaw. And when she published this book, she was married to a man named Schmidt. Do you know how to spell that?
S-C-H-M-I-D-T.
Yeah, M-I-D-T. And it's called Letters for God's Name. Dorothy Sayers. And that particular thing is called The Mind of the Maker. I was also reading her mystery novel. Sort of discussion about science and religion, and which turns on the twist in molecular structure. Finally, the murder, solving the murder does. And I think that she must have been writing those two things at the same time. Although the documents of the case doesn't have Peter Wimsey in it, so I was very disappointed. But and then Simone Veil is. This particular essay is in a collection called Waiting for God. And this one is available in the Holden bookstore. I saw a couple copies in there earlier in the week.
There are some Sayers things in there too, but I can't remember if The Mind of the Maker is one of them.
Yeah, I think it's like God Ignite, which is
well,
a one.
Mysteries, but there's
some. Oh, are there some of her essays there as well?
There's something on the right hand side, but I can't remember what it is. Yeah, I looked at it.
Okay. Her mysteries are also wonderful. Many, many mystery writers, readers have gotten hooked on them by reading Dorothy Sayers, and nobody else ever quite comes up to Dorothy Sayers.
I'm intrigued. Have you read Douglas Child Hall, Imitating, or not?
Yeah.
Imaging of
God.
Okay,
yes.
The whole business about relationship is coming through strongly in your
Yeah. And that's another wonderful piece, especially if you're interested in a sort of second article, Christ redemption-based look at issues about creation and environment. Douglas John Hall's, I think it's called Imaging God.
Imaging God.
Is a wonderful piece, and I think quite readable, and a very solid piece of work.
About the triangularity there too.
No, see, I read that last fall, and it's probably lodged somewhere in my brain.
In there yeah. Yeah.
Well, there's also the fact that everyone who grows up in Christian environment has a triangularity in their brain. Mm-hmm. We just see things in threes, I think.
And there was, I mean, I think of God so much in terms of a verb. Mm-hmm. In fact, the word Yahweh, I mean, whatever it means. I am who I am, or I was who I was, or will be who I will be. For me, I like to think of the image of God in terms of action. And so mm-hmm. I like his use of imaging God. So.
Right. Yeah, that it's an ongoing thing. And it goes well with a thing that theologians are learning from scientists these days, namely to think about creation as an ongoing activity, not as something that was done once and finished. Also not to be confused with recreation, which is redemption. They're yoked activities. They're yoked activities, but they're not the same. Which is what I found so fortuitous when I trooped over to the library at the University of Washington and looked up image. You know, I thought, well, I should just look, you know, do a little etymology here, you know. And there was this wonderful explanation from physics about the way an image is the thing and isn't the thing. That there's always difference as well as similarity. And I think that's something too important to think about this week when we're talking about multicultural issues. That to simply just say, oh, well, you're just like me, we're all human, is to deny something important about each of us, which is our own uniqueness and our membership in a variety of groups. To say, when one of my colleagues or students says to me, oh, you're so smart, you think just like a man. I think, no, I don't. No, if that's what you think about me, you've missed something. It's not the only thing you need to know about me, that I'm a woman, but if you deny it, then you don't know me. Okay? If you deny that I'm an American, you don't know me. If you deny that I'm white, you don't know me. That we have to come up against the friction of difference and make that friction into some kind of constructive energy, not pretend like it's not there. Because otherwise it'll catch on fire, as it has many times in the past. Fire that gets out of control.
So. You touched on one of the questions that was raised for me as you talked about Christ and imitating Christ. And a sentence that uses made and then remade, just exactly what happens in redemption. Is it returning to creation or is it something else? And not that your essay is a place to explore that, but I was left with the question, well, what for you is redemption? And it sounded like a return to creation. So I guess I would ask that Christologically.
I don't think it's a return. Okay. But also I don't think it's a total making out of nothing. So that it's not that who we are is cast aside. And that's why the seeing Railroad Creek, that if you walk down to the ball field, I mean, the great thing about that you guys have from hearing this, that the people who read it in the Crescent won't have, is you can say, oh yeah, Mount Bonanza, oh yeah, Railroad Creek, you know all those spaces. If you walk down toward the ball field and then you go toward the creek, you can see there's an enormous rock there. And my husband said when he was here in 1980, that was by the shore. You could, and it was a great fishing rock. Everybody would go and sit on that rock and fish. Well, now the river is like from here to the wall, and then there's the rock. And the rock is being reshaped. And you can see that I think maybe by next year or the year after next, there's going to be a bridge out to that rock because there's this enormous tree whose roots are almost totally undercut, right? And that's sort of, for me, a description of this remaking. You know, it's there, and we recognize it, but it will be different. And maybe that goes back to what I think is one of the great, wonderful, realistic parts of Lutheran theology, that we are simultaneously saints and sinners. It's all mixed up in each of us, and every day it's a renewal, sort of effort to keep those going, you know, to keep the saved part going. It's not our effort, it's our effort, but it's our effort with the engine of God's Spirit pushing us along. Well, if that's the case, then this redeemed thing isn't wholly other from the unredeemed thing. And that's, I don't know if that addresses your question.
Yeah, it does.
To me, the image of God is more of a emotional state of mind that brings to consciousness the effects of his activeness mm-hmm. in one's life.
Yeah, so that we're able to recognize.
So like through a death, mm-hmm. there's the image of God. And then through life, like at a birth, there's the image of God. That feeling of joy and excitement.
Yeah.
So it's like you can't have just one, you gotta have it all.
Lots. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think so. And I also think that it's that is one of the reasons why Sayers' notion of imagination and creativity, I think, is very appealing, because that's what allows us to see mm-hmm. God's action, because we haven't seen. It's a Pauline theme all the time. We have it in earthen vessels. We see in a mirror dimly what the eye has not yet seen or the ear heard. Faith is the hope of things not seen, you know, and yet somehow we get a sense of what will be, indeed is. That's the whole of Christian existence is in this funny time warp that we call the already, but not yet. Okay? redemption is already complete, and yet it is not yet finished. And it's this funny, you know, it's like when you already bought the plane ticket, but you aren't on the plane yet. You know you're going to be there. You start to anticipate it, but it hasn't happened. You're in between. The visit hasn't occurred. And so in the midst of that, that's very helpful, that part of the image for God is being able to recognize God's action. That's maybe one of the places where I have some hesitations about certain expressions of creation spirituality. I tried to be very careful about that in here. Maybe you remember the little part about the tree that's ripped up by its roots and the sapling is in the tree. And I say, because I know from Scripture that God brings good from evil and life from death, when I see that, and there's a great example of it just down on the nature trail behind Narnia, and there are lots of them, you know, it's all over. Because I know that already from Scripture, I recognize it when I see it in the image. Okay. That the revelation comes first, and then I see it. That I don't see it first there and then know it. But I also want to preserve the interaction of the two, and not to say, oh, it's only in the Bible. We only learn about God from the Bible, from the revealed Word of God. That's the only place, because it's not. But it is a particular place that has pride of place in our community. I mean, you could define Christianity as the group of people who say that in the Bible we hear God's voice. Right? That there are lots of ways to define Christianity. That wouldn't be a totally adequate one, but it would be a true one. Okay, we are defined by our book. That's what we have in common with Jews and with the Islamic people, that we are religions of the book. We have slightly different books, but we all have recourse to the book, animated by the Spirit, animated by the living Word, okay, who is Christ.
Yeah. I was struck by your conclusion of the story about the hiker. The first thinking, obviously very current.
Yeah, and I probably should have said something about that before we started. I'm sorry.
It would be easy for the reader to get off on maybe a theodicy tangent, but on the other hand, I think that's part of what underlies the whole business. And I wonder if there might be a danger in losing the hiddenness of God when you talk about Christ as the image of the invisible God. I mean, God is still hidden in
yeah.
the revealed Christ.
Yep.
Plus, there's still the Deus Absconditus who's
yep.
still out there.
I'm
afraid that a reader might collapse all of that. Into
yeah,
the
could be.
I don't know. Just a comment.
Yeah, it seems to me this I began to realize when I was forced to review in public John Updike's book Roger's Version. I don't like John Updike at all. I'll just say that right out front. And when I was asked to do that, I said that. I said, I don't like John Updike, and frankly, there are other people on this campus, the place where I had to do it. His bibliographer was on the, and I was a little embarrassed. I have to get up and review John Updike's book, and I don't really like him. But what I was struck by in that book is that, at least in that book, Updike is not asking questions about how to justify God. How do we make God right in view of the evil of the world? How do we say that God is okay? That's not his question, although that is usually the modern question. I think that's what many, many people ask. But Updike's question was about how do we see God? The question of epiphany, when the light is revealed. And so partly what I want to do with the hiker's death is to shift the question. What is this the answer to if it's a different question? Whether the incarnation collapses the hiddenness of God is certainly a perennial theological question. And it may be, one of the things I've done some work on is 19th century abolitionists, female abolitionists. One of the things that's very striking about them is that I think they do that. That people who have a high anthropology, namely they expect a lot from human beings, tend to have what we call a low Christology, so that you talk about Jesus is a moral model, Jesus is a wonderful teacher, Jesus is a fine fellow. We'd all love to have him in our neighborhood. But it contains Jesus and makes it wipes out the spaces, okay, to use my language here. It wipes out the spaces. It's all correspondence. And so what I'm just hinting at here, David, is that if we concentrate on any one person of the Trinity, that will happen. So that it happens, there's a lot of Jesusolatry in the church, you know, where Jesus is the whole thing, and you forget about the Father, the Creator, the Maker, the Holy One, the frightening God of the volcano. And we forget about the Spirit. We want everything to be Jesus, because gentle Jesus, meek and mild, who would be afraid of him, you know? But you can do the same thing with the Spirit and forget about the other two, and you can do the same thing with the first person of the Trinity and forget about Jesus. Forget about the particularity, the scandal that our God appeared in one person, in one place, in one time. You know? And if you're going to be Jesus of Nazareth, you can't be anybody else. You can only be Jesus of Nazareth. And there are those differences then that we rub up against. So I would say, yeah, there's that danger, but I think that's one of the things about the Trinity that's really wonderful. And those of you who read or are aware of some of the current theological debates in Lutheranism will recognize that very quietly I'm trying to say something about what's a very hot topic, namely, you know, what's the status of the Trinity and how do we understand the Trinity? And I think it's being used as a club when it shouldn't be a club. It should be an object of wonder and gratitude and joy. And I don't want to give it up just because somebody else is trying to beat me on the head with it. Say, you know, there's that little phrase about abuse does not nullify right use. I'm not going to give up the Trinity just because some people, I think, have it wrong.
How do they have it wrong?
Because I don't think they understand about the difference, the spaces.
They think they're really all one.
No, they don't think they're all one mold together. But for example, one of the debates is about whether Father, Son, and Holy Spirit is the revealed name of God, God's given name, and that if you would speak to God using any other terminology, that would be incorrect address, and perhaps even in
sinful,
yeah, sinful and not efficacious. That God would not hear you. It wouldn't work. That, now, I'm a historian, right? And so I have a lot of appreciation for what went before, and I would be willing to say, okay, yeah, let's say for baptisms we use Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Okay, let's do that. Fine. But every other time, let's say you can do whatever you want. You know? But that's not the tone of the argument, mm-hmm. You know, that this is the formula that's been used at least since Chalcedon, which was 451. That's when the doctrine of the Trinity was established. 451. Mm-hmm. Okay, if we give Jesus 31 years of earthly life, that means 420 years after the death and resurrection of Jesus, we get the doctrine of the Trinity. I bet there were a lot of people baptized in there who didn't get baptized in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And I don't think... Yeah, I don't think that it didn't work. Mm-hmm. I think it did work.
Okay. Well, you have three persons in the Trinity. Is there any reason why you couldn't consider the Spirit the feminine part?
Some do. Some do. What's even more interesting to me is when you read medieval texts, and we were talking a little bit about this on Monday evening, that often Jesus is considered a feminine character. In the paragraph after, Jesus was a masculine character. So you'll have a sort of paragraph in a text about Jesus as the bridegroom, mm-hmm. and in the next Jesus as the mother. No, just the mother. The mother nursing the Christian. And there are two reasons, I think, for that. One is that medieval people didn't have such a bipolar understanding of gender. We have very, you are a man or you are a woman. And we don't like that to get confused at all. Very clear. And we can think of all kinds of examples of that. You know, try talking to someone, one of your friends, about someone you've just met, and don't give them any clues as to the sex of the person you're talking about. They get very, we just want to know that about people right away, mm-hmm. right? So that's part of it. The other reason is that they had very peculiar understanding of biology, and they thought that all fluids were processed blood, okay? So they understood that mother's milk was a kind of processed blood. And if you see a picture of Jesus on the cross with this wound right here, right, it doesn't take much imagination to think of that wound where Jesus' blood is flowing out as lactation. Right, and so then they'll have these long passages about the soul nursing at Jesus' breast. And it seems really bizarre to us. Because we don't have the antecedents for it, you know. It's like, whoa, that's really strange. But it is helpful, I think, to at least expand the possibilities, even if we don't want that one.
Why has it become such an important issue? I've heard people argue the point about the image of God. Is he a he or a she? I don't understand why is it.
Let me see if I can give you a short answer.
I just don't understand.
Yeah,
why
I know. Let me try and give you a short answer. It's because of the way human beings have tried to take control of God, and that theology gets laid beside human power relationships, and religious things get used to reinforce those. So that although almost every theologian in the history of Christianity would say, until nowadays, God is not a male, they nonetheless used language that suggested that God is a male. Most often, you know, the stuff that I just told you is a kind of minority report. Okay. So what has happened is that the sort of sloppy suggestion that divinity is associated with masculinity has reinforced the oppression of women. Now, you may think it doesn't have to, but it has. Historically, that has happened. And so, particularly as women have tried to understand that, it's become an issue. It's become an issue to say, well, is God, you know, let's talk about whether this is mysterious language or factual language. Another piece to it, which is a contemporary piece, is it seems like in the late 20th century we all want to understand how God is like us. We're less interested in how God is different from us. And that's this stuff about medieval images for God, the masculine and feminine ones. What's very fascinating is that one of the scholars who's done the most work on this suggests that women tended to use the nuptial imagery, okay? Jesus as the bridegroom, and men tended to use the maternal imagery, Jesus as mother. So that in the medieval church, it looks like people were more attracted to the image of God that was unlike them. Whereas in our time, it seems like people are more attracted to the image of God that is like us. So there's been a sort of flip-flop in what is efficacious. Although, again, part of what I'm doing here is trying to make a case for the difference as well as for the similarity. To say that we need both. if Jesus is only like me, I don't see that he can save me. Because I sure can't save me. No matter how hard I try, I am still impatient, proud. You know, there I could name off some more of my faults, but, you know, that's enough to reveal just on this spur of the moment. I can't get rid of those. I try every day. Even when I remember to do like Luther says, when I wash my face, say I am baptized, you know, the old person dies, the new person rises. Then I go out to the dining hall and I'm impatient right away. You know, I probably don't have to get out of the door before I'm impatient. I can't do it myself. So if Jesus is only like me, frankly, I don't really need it. I need someone who's different from me. Someone who's enough like me not to give up on me. Enough like me to understand, but enough different to be able to help me.
Let's place both human and divine.
Exactly. Precisely. Yeah.
We're not divine.
Yes. Yeah. And the humanity is necessary for compassion.
So I say he understands the things we go through. There's, I forget the verses, but he understands and all the sufferings we have. Because when he was weak and couldn't use all his powers, either because he wouldn't or because he couldn't, because it wasn't part of it.
Right.
To feel the weakness.
The wonderful hymn in Philippians about not counting equality with God a thing to be grasped. And that's at the heart of Simone Weil's essay. This, she says that to use power over something is the natural way. That's the way it is. We just do that. What is remarkable is when we don't use our power. And that's true compassion. It doesn't wipe out the difference, but it treats the other as though there was no difference. And then what she calls pure gratitude arises from recognizing, from the afflicted one, her term there is to talk about affliction. When the afflicted one says, I know you didn't have to do that. That the way of the world would be that you just step on me, but you didn't. And then that's pure gratitude. Well, thank you very much. It's been wonderful to talk to you about these things, and it reassures me that I did really write something that I'm happy with.